SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Friday, race fans, and a happy Easter and a happy Passover. Good Pesach tomorrow and Sunday. And, of course, in the great tradition of bizarre rules in American racing in various jurisdictions, no racing in New York Sunday, no training, can't do anything. But the casinos are open, and you can buy lottery tickets. You just can't play the horses. It's unbelievable. Now, they did eliminate Palm Sunday from that, you know, from that portion, right? So I hope everybody has a wonderful holiday weekend, and I know there's a lot of vacations next week, including Tina. Tina's off. And she threatened to come to Louisville with me. She said, "What will be going on next week?" Nothing, honey. It's the week before Derby week, and it won't be that interesting per se. And yeah, can I say? There's not that much. It's the prequel to Derby week. And of course, we'll head out this afternoon as soon as we wrap up the show and do the final packing and so forth. Meanwhile, there is a nice, you get these two in between weekends ahead of Derby Oaks, and you know, there's lots to keep us occupied, right? No shortage of activity to keep you engaged. And that includes at Keeneland today, the Double Dog Dare, and the Elkhorn tomorrow. So Keeneland action continues. And it is notable when we talk to Marty. Marty will be in the second hour today. But the notable topic out of this Double Dog Dare today, Blue Prize. She's not going to run, which makes this, I mean, she was 5-2 morning line, but she was going to go off at 4-5 in this group. Not that it's a bad group, but she was going to be a heavy favorite. With Blue Prize out of the Double Dog Dare today, it's pretty competitive. So we'll see what Marty thinks, and you'll look for the wonderful Blue Prize, Nacho Correas. We'll look for the Argentinian mare, Oaks Day in the La Troyenne, going the mile and a 16th. And the why not? The grade one. Why wouldn't you? And that La Troyenne, by the way, I will reiterate what I mentioned about the $2 pick six that they're going to run Friday and Saturday. It's going to be very interesting. The pick six will include the six grade ones Friday and Saturday, the La Troyenne and the Oaks on Friday, and then the Humana Distaff, the Churchill Downs Handicap, the Turf Classic, the Old Forester, by the way. Thank you, Susan, our friend Susan Luchik, delivering me the bottle of Old Forester, the correct bourbon that is currently sponsoring the Turf Classic, the Old Forester Turf Classic, and the Derby. So six grade ones, and they will pay out. They eliminated any of those annoying provisos that were pretty irksome in terms of taking Derby money or pick six money from Saturday and putting it into other things. Instead, it'll be paid one way or another on Saturday, whether it has to go to five of six or who knows. But six grade ones together, Friday, a two-day pick six. I think it's a very clever idea, and I'm sure Ed DeRosa will take credit for it, whether it was his idea or not. I'm just kidding. We'll talk to Ed and Scully later. Quick rundown today, and in addition to Ed and James later, we've got Marty McGee, I mentioned. Marty will be around 10:40. We'll check in with Hammer. Nick Tamaro back after traveling last week. Nick will look at the cross-country pick five. And Jay Pridman, the post-prep season derby watch. And after a first break this morning, in about 10 minutes, new grandfather, Alan Foreman of the THA. And I've got a laundry list of topics for Alan. And that was even before yesterday's coalition, quote-unquote, of racetracks that are forwarding the concept of no race day LASIKs, starting with two-year-olds in 2020 and then in stake races in 2021. And there's any number of intended and unintended consequences potentially out of this, and we'll let Alan, who has probably the most comprehensive position in the industry to understand whether this even happens or happens in modified format, happens as proposed, what portions of this could and could not work ultimately. If you haven't read the THA response, I sent out the links to Alan's written response and to Eric Hamelbeck's from the perspective of the National HBPA, and both of them are reasoned and rational and approach this topic, particularly from the aspect of horsemen and owners. And that's their, in this particular case, I mean, particularly with Eric, the National HBPA, that's their, that's their constituency. And Eric, specifically takes issue. Let me preface all of this by saying that no one necessarily is adverse to a debate and to a process on this topic. But the manner in which this is been reacted, pretty reactive away from the Santa Anita circumstances, a knee-jerk response, and the cynical posture that this is somehow a concept that is being done for the good of the horse and for as a safety initiative and as something, it is just preposterous. It's just ridiculous. Because the opposite very well may be true, that in fact it has a negative potential on the safety and well-being of the racehorse, all of which suffer from EIPH, from exercise-induced pulmonary hemorrhage. Every one of them, to some degree, tiny bit, and they might go 10 career starts, and who knows? And the mechanics of it are very involved and intricate, and we continue to study and, whether it's, from the veterinary perspective and, every other angle. But to posture this as some sort of a safety initiative and something that's in the best interest of the horse is just preposterous. It doesn't make any sense. Because this is a, as we've said 1,000 times, I mean, the fact that this debate even has to, with so many other issues that are important to, the ongoing the ongoing health of the industry, the fact that this just, you know, thanks in part to the Jockey Club painting everybody, you know, all the American horsemen with this negative brush. That's as much a part of it as anything. But I don't think anybody would have minded having a, you know, comprehensive approach, but to knee-jerk this the way it's been done, thanks to the ineptitude out west, is just ridiculous. Equally ridiculous is this notion that doing this is going to somehow this will lead to the breeding out of bleeding, that by doing this you'll eliminate the blood stock that passes on bleeding. That's the funniest suggestion, given that, you know, so here they are in Europe and they no race day, and internationally no race day Lasix, and yet the progeny being produced by those stallions and that blood stock produces, it seems to produce, bleeders because they get sent here to race. But yet, supposedly, we will breed the bleeding out of them. No, you won't. You're not going to. It's not possible. They all bleed. So, I mean, that one is the most ridiculous. I mean, if you want to have an argument, a discussion, that, you know, there's a wider benefit to this and perception and blah, blah, that's fine. But don't try to advance that complete and utter falsehood. You're gonna breed them out in one generation. Oh, yeah, sure you are. Why don't you experiment with that with your own horses? I mean, it's just silly. Whole thing is, to me, is just energy sapping. Alan will also address, you know, the Mid-Atlantic group that, you know, have been putting together, and in fact, in advance of any of the things that have happened here in the last 6-8 weeks, they had put together a plan to address, you know, the potential for racing and training related fatalities, and that has kind of gotten lost in a lot of the sound and fury. We'll talk about the match series, which kicks off tomorrow at Laurel. Got a nice set of four right in a row, the Whiteley and the Leatherberry, the Primanetta and the Dahlia. Drew nice big fields, and from Laurel it'll go to Penn, to Delaware, to Parks, to Monmouth between now and September. And the match series back for its second year since the rebirth. I want Alan to also address what went on in Maryland with Pimlico, with the closing of the grandstand, and whether that was some sort of a political process that influenced things, or whether it, who knows? It's a mystery. What's going on? Where things are going to go there. Keeneland yesterday, Wesley Ward, with that declaration of war colt that he bred out of Aventure Love, an Orpen mare. Joker on Jack, nice winner, and upset Todd Pletcher and Calumet's Ragtag, who was like 3-5. And also, I sent a note to Charlie Lopresti. I was thrilled to see Charlie win that $100,000 maiden race. First time 3-year-old, Urban Insight. Good job, Charlie. Got a nice figure, too. Got like an 84 or an 86 buyer. And Desert Ride, that Candy Ride filly, the Ontario bred from Samsung, allowance winner. Saw that race live. And Rusty Arnold has done a hell of a job with Leanster. 91 buyer winning that allowance. Back after this, Alan Foreman starts us off. Weekend preview at the races.
The latest racing news. It's at the races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest. We know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet, and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $100 are on them. That's right. Sign up with ExpressBet.com using promo code XBRadio, bet $100, and they'll deposit $100 back into your account the very next day. Hey, plus you could get an extra $25 if you use Express Fund Direct Deposit. You see what I mean? House money for betting the races. It's that easy. Check it out at ExpressBet.com to learn more. And don't forget to sign up for promo code XBRadio. You're gonna love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee. Must be 18 years or older and 21 years old in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void or prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.
With 35 years at the forefront of sports technology, Stats provides next generation sports content for basketball, baseball, football, soccer. And now Stats is turning its sights to horse racing. RaceLens is the most in-depth product on the market. With innovative analytics powered by data from Equibase, it will change the way you follow horse racing. Stats RaceLens, bringing clarity to handicapping. Learn more at stats.com/racelens.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Bright light, big cities, gone to my baby's head. Oh, bright light, big cities, gone to my baby's head. I try to tell the woman, but she don't.
We're back at the races, just about 18 after, and Alan Foreman is going to join us here. A couple of notes before we get to Alan, who, Alan's ready. All right, so we can go straight to Alan Foreman, and I can, for those of you that didn't see it on Twitter this morning when I mentioned it, new grandfather, and couldn't be happier for Alan and the family. Mazel tov. The baby, did the baby float in among the rushes in a basket in the Chesapeake, or how did this one arrive? Yeah. It is Passover season.
Nah, it's a Philly and it's a New York bred. thanks, Steve. Obviously we're over the moon this morning. My oldest son had our first grandchild, a granddaughter, last night, and we're in New York, and with all that's going on in the industry, what a lift this was. So we're very excited. Thank you for the kind words. And I've gotten so many texts and emails and you name it. It's just a wonderful moment in our life. Thank you.
Not at all. And you talk about the state of affairs. We were going to talk anyway because there was a bunch of follow-up from some things we discussed last week. And then the word started to come earlier in the week initially Churchill, Keeneland, Naira floating and massaging around a potential two-year-old slash stakes Lasix ban. And then by the time we got to yesterday, it had permeated a large percentage of racetracks and organizations around the country. And you and Eric Hamelbeck, I thought, wrote very reasonable and rational responses to it. Alan, explain what they're proposing, its feasibility, its potential benefits, its potential negatives, and how the industry should react.
Well, we've not been consulted on it, so I can only comment based upon what we've heard and what we've read. But it appears that what they call a coalition of racetracks, and I guess some organizations are proposing, is to eliminate the administration of race day medication, Lasix, to two-year-olds beginning next year in 2020, and then beginning in 2021, Lasix would not be permitted to be administered to horses running in all stakes races. So it's what they call a partial ban. I'm not sure why they're doing a partial ban and not an entire ban, but that's what they're proposing. And it's going to require, in most jurisdictions, regulatory approval. The current manner in which the administration of Lasix is permitted in this country is by strict regulation. It is the single most uniform medication policy program regime that we have in horse racing. Everybody does it the same. The rules are the same everywhere. For those who scream about uniformity, this is really the most uniform medication under very strict supervision, very strict control. We will now have a system, if in fact this is implemented, that is not uniform, that will be patchwork, that will be different from state to state because, again, as I said, it's going to require regulatory approval in most jurisdictions, and I would assume some racing commissions will accept this policy and change the rules, and there will be other states that will not. And it will no doubt pit some tracks against other tracks and some states against other states, which is certainly contrary to what we've been trying to do in the industry. And to me, it's certainly a setback for this unique opportunity that we have right now with the problems that we have in racing to actually join together with consensus-based protocols and reforms that will help us to identify why horses are breaking down and how we can prevent it from happening in the future. And that's what we've been laser focused on, and this is a misdirection, and I assume it's being done to appease animal rights groups and others, but it's dividing the industry. We're more divided this morning now than probably we've been in a long time. So it's very unfortunate. I'm really very disappointed about it.
Alan, what would you expect to happen in the short term here? Is this a model that can be massaged and more widely discussed, and does it have practical application that can work, or is this simply a imperative that the proverbial march or die, either come along or be left behind kind of a statement?
Well, here's the problem. Even the proponents of this partial ban yesterday admitted that changing our race day medication policy, either partially or entirely banning Lasix, has absolutely nothing to do whatsoever with the problem that we're having with horses that are breaking down. So there's a disconnect already. There was an international summit at Belmont Park in 2011 where we brought all the experts from around the world and all of the industry stakeholders together to look at the very issue of race day medication, learn as much as we could from the experts, and try to decide whether or not we needed to adjust our policy. And after a two-day facilitated summit, it was determined to leave the current situation, the current protocols in place and tighten them, make them stricter and make them more uniform. There was a committee appointed to further study the issue of whether or not to perhaps limit or ban the administration of Lasix to two-year-olds at that time, and also to eliminate their use in stakes races. And that committee determined not to do it. And in my view, nothing has changed scientifically since that time. The problem with this proposal yesterday is that they basically turned their back on science. Our position, whether we're criticized or not, is totally scientifically based. Lasix is good for the horse. It's good for I think it's good for racing here because the bettors like it because it provides for a level playing field. And when I started in the business before Lasix had been actually discovered as a very effective drug for this phenomenon called EIPH in horses, trainers were doing all kinds of things because horses were bleeding. They were doing what they could to prevent the horses from bleeding, and it was a mess. So Lasix was actually a wonder drug. It's just been demonized over the past 4 or 5 years with some association to international standards. So our concern is that a very safe and effective drug for what has been classified by the American Veterinary Medical Association as a disease in horses, and you have a medication that is safe and effective and is not harmful to the horse, is now being taken away from the horse. When you do it in two-year-olds, it's the young horses where you want to get this disease under control quickly. So depriving a two-year-old who may bleed in a race from it is actually not in the horse's best interest. And it's disappointing that those who are proponents are not listening to the scientific community. They are dismissing the scientific community. It's almost like a debate about climate change. And it's dividing the industry. There will be, obviously, we'll sit down, we'll have serious conversations with, as we always do in this industry, about what to do. But I'm not optimistic that there will be a consensus that is going to lead us in the right direction.
I want to bring up the piece that Kelsey Riley wrote in TDN about, must be 10, 12 days ago, which talked about, it was fascinating. She did a terrific research piece on what they did in South America starting 6 years ago and the phase out that South America jurisdictions attempted. And they've been successful and haven't noticed any, you know, any major change, essentially, in terms of the competition and in terms of bleeding incidents. Did you any reaction to that, Alan? I'm assuming you saw that piece.
No, I did. I thought it was interesting, but what also caught my attention was that trainers are resorting to other strategies,
right,
in order to try to prevent a horse from bleeding during a race, including, if I recall, loading up the horse with dextrose the day before a race, and there are other things they're doing, which I would question, is that in the best interest of the horse? One of the tried and true strategies, and I said this when I testified in Congress last June, is they withdraw water from the horse for 24 hours before a race. Is that humane? Is that right? I guarantee you there will be other products on the market, strategies, the things that happened before Lasix was legalized. And I know people will say, well, Foreman's being overdramatic, but the fact of the matter is the trainers are going to do what they have to do to manage this situation because they deal with it all the time. And it's their responsibility to do what's in the best interest of the horse, and resorting to strategies that where people have, you know, the guy in the barn next to me, or I hear that this works or that works, you're going to see a lot of experimentation, and you're going to see a lot of things occur that I just don't think are in the best interest of the horse. And I don't think the bettors, look, do we do things because of the bettors? No, we do things because of what's in the best interest of the horse. And that's where I am. That's where I've always been. And people can disagree with me. But I think it was Stu Janney who said, Lasix is good for the horse, but bad for the business. And I don't think you make decisions based on economics. I think you make your primary decisions based on what's best for the horse.
A couple of questions that popped up in my mind, and you mentioned the what feels like a two-tier potential scenario in the way this was floated. And I imagine, Alan, that there's potential here if we're going to focus on two-year-olds and basically starting their careers without Lasix, and then I suppose once they turn three and start to become older horses, four, five, six, there's the opportunity maybe to utilize Lasix at that point in their careers if they develop into bleeders, and that the stakes level would compete without Lasix. Is that potentially a workable scenario that the horses that don't gravitate up toward stake level, that they could utilize Lasix in the meat and potatoes level of racing, and that you have to prove out essentially as a non-bleeder to make it to the upper levels?
Well, yeah, the upper levels, a lot of tracks, just because of the way purse levels have changed, are calling races stakes. For example, we're doing the Match Series starting tomorrow. All of the races in that series are stakes races. A lot of them are races that were created for the series that were given a name and called a stake. And if this policy takes effect, then all of the races in the Match Series would have to be non-Lasix races, which would probably kill the series, because if all the tracks didn't adopt a non-Lasix policy for stakes races, then, for example, New Jersey wouldn't be able to card in that series races because they would be non-Lasix. Arguably, Maryland, if Maryland were, I don't think it will, but if Maryland were to go non-Lasix, then you'd have horses not running on Lasix in Maryland, running on Lasix in New Jersey, and that's just the kind of chaos that we don't need. I'm sure there will be some discussion about whether or not there should be two-year-old racing at all now. Is it in the best interest of the horse if you're going to deprive a young horse of a necessary medication that's safe and effective and prevents disease? Should we be running two-year-olds at all? It's going to be a very complicated conversation, and it's going to, in many places, pit the horsemen against the racetracks. It's going to pit potentially horsemen against regulator against racetrack. I mean, it's going to be a battle, and I can tell you that Maryland horsemen and breeders have already determined that they're going to oppose any change. New Jersey's going to oppose a change. I think you're going to find most of the jurisdictions in the Mid-Atlantic are not going to embrace this change. So it's going to be, you're going to go jurisdiction to jurisdiction. What's going to happen in Florida? Florida doesn't have a racing commission. Florida adopts the national model rules, which would require ARCI to adopt a model rule and then other jurisdictions to follow. Are the racing commissioners international going to propose a model rule to eliminate Lasix and two-year-olds in graded stakes races? So it's a complicated scenario.
Well, it's a jumping off point, and we will watch and see where it goes from here, and we'll address the line drives and ground balls as they come at us, and that's just what you can do. A couple of things, Alan, that we also have to touch on, and as part of this, and as part of the whole cacophony that came out of Santa Anita, it overshadowed the release of the Mid-Atlantic plan to reduce fatalities, something you'd been working on well before anything transpired as it did over the winter at Santa Anita. And give everybody a thumbnail of that, because it's been unfairly overshadowed.
Well, Steve, thank you. It's been something that we've been laser-focused on in the Mid-Atlantic since the release of the New York Task Force report on racehorse health and safety, the follow-up to the very similar situation at Aqueduct in 2011-2012 with the 21 fatalities that occurred under many similar circumstances to what occurred at Santa Anita. And the Mid-Atlantic region not only began to enact the reforms that were recommended in that task force report, but also committed to create a long-term strategic plan where the region could work collectively, sharing information, identifying horses at risk, improving pre-race examinations, statistically looking at not only identifying horses at risk, but factors that may lead to breakdowns, looking at racing surfaces, looking at coordination between racing offices, conferring with our scientific community. And so we began this effort 2 years ago. We began implementing reforms, and then at our meeting last month, the Mid-Atlantic meeting, which is the Mid-Atlantic is the largest daily concentration of racing in the United States. We had more than 90,000 starts last year. We all pledged to implement a long-term plan and strategy with serious meat on the bone to try to identify horses at risk and reduce fatalities. And we've got evidence-based results to show that what we're doing works. New York had the lowest fatality rate it's had in decades. And there's been I believe it's a 35% reduction in breakdowns and fatalities in the Mid-Atlantic region since 2013. So we know it's working, and we have a far different story to tell than what's happening at Santa Anita. But you know, it gets obliterated in all the you know attentions that's being given out in California, certainly, but throughout the rest of the industry. You know, it's a really a good piece of work. We're all serious about it. We've all bought into it. And quite frankly, Steve, that's what we're going to focus on. We're not going to get bogged down in a misdirected argument about race day medication that has nothing to do with this. We're going to focus on how to make our industry safer for our athletes and justify public confidence in our sport.
Well, and I wanted to bring it up again. We touched on it in the wake of the Mid-Atlantic Conference, which I'm delighted that I was able to attend. And I loved when the specifics came out, and when the news portion came out, and the lunacy on the internet hailed it as, oh, look how reactive the industry is. The industry was so reactive that it was being worked on for 3.5-4 years. That was the reactive. I mean, the people immediately assumed, oh, this is something that they did because of California. No, this is something that was worked on, massaged, had input from all points on the compass to affect positive impact on the care and maintenance of the equine athlete. It is infuriating, Alan, to have stuff thrown at, mud slung at every attempt and absolute honest and well-meant work that people put in, including lots of unpaid representatives that work as representing owners and trainers and breeders. It's just amazing how little actual interest and effort goes into understanding what is happening behind the scenes on all of these topics. And maybe I'm just sensitive to it because I've been trying to, you know, show people what goes on behind the curtain, whether it's whether it was RMTC and RCI and, you know, all the different portions of regulation and effort that goes into the industry. And, you know, people just say the stupidest things without making any attempt to understand.
Well, Steve, I've learned over the years now that the place to make things happen is in the Mid-Atlantic. The Mid-Atlantic region is so far ahead of the rest of the industry, and we kind of sit back and watch the... I understand we went through this in New York. I understand the difficulties at Santa Anita and in California, but they're knee-jerk reacting, and that's not anybody's best interest. Some of the reforms that they've proposed, where are they coming from? What is the scientific basis for them, other than it sounds tough and it sounds good? In many respects, the Churchill announcement yesterday of the reforms that they're implementing somewhat has the same tone. They're taking from the Mid-Atlantic. They're taking from California. They're taking from different baskets to come up with their own plan that may sound very good, but it's just not a coordinated effort. And I think it's a very huge missed opportunity for the industry that ought to look at the Mid-Atlantic, use us as the lab experiment, because we've got every constituency, every stakeholder group, regulators, veterinarians, horsemen, trainers, owners, breeders organizations, all working as one with one common goal, and that is the North Star is the safety and welfare of our horses, and everything that we're doing is directed at making racing safer in the Mid-Atlantic for our horses. And we have evidence-based facts to show that what we're doing is working. Are we done? My God, no. One fatality is too much. Everything we're doing is designed to get to the lowest number possible. The good news is that we're doing it. And the key here is, I can't emphasize it enough, it's not race day medication. We have horses who have pre-existing injuries. We have to identify them, and we have to ensure that horses going to the starting gate should be going to the starting gate. And if they have a breakdown, it's not because we missed something that could have prevented it.
Well, and preventative efforts, and that's actually what Lasix is. In fact, Woodbury Payne just sent me a note, and, you know, Wood brings up a tremendous point, how EIPH is cumulative, and, in fact, depriving two-year-olds has the potential to worsen a situation for a horse long-term, for their long-term health and well-being. And That part of it, you know, preventive care, that's what got an inexpensive way of inhibiting EIPH developing. Why this has been turned into the, you know, the specter of you know, that it's been. I think we know how and why.
Steve, misguided. This has been studied. I mean, Yep. You know, they like to criticize the vet community, that somehow the vet community has some financial investment in maintaining this current policy. And one of the proponents of the federal bill actually said that at the hearing in Washington last June, and I think everyone was incredulous. The scientific experts that we have who study these things and who are highly respected internationally are responsible for the veterinary policy that says, absent an effective alternative for the treatment of EIPH in the horse, the current regulatory scheme and horse racing in the United States should be continued. So, and as we've said, when there is a discovery or there is some better way to manage these horses that we can embrace, we'll gladly do that. But right now, to deprive the horse of something that is safe, not deleterious to the horse, effective, and essentially provides for a level playing field for all the participants, why would you change that? Makes no sense.
Well, have changed the format this year. Alan, let's get the other handful of topics I want to run by you. Change in the format for Match Series 2.0, and that includes festival-style racing at five venues between now and September, Laurel Penn, Delaware Parks, and Monmouth. And we start tomorrow. Got terrific participation for the Whiteley, the King Leatherberry, the Primanetta, and the Dahlia.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. We're very excited. We did make a major change this year. You know, we ran the Match Series for 5 years, from 1997 to 2002. We brought it back last year under a format where we had either four or five divisions, and we would have a race in the region almost every week. And I guess now looking back on it, it was probably hard for people to follow, notwithstanding it was very popular. So it was suggested this year, and I think it's based on the fact that three of the championship races last year ended up at Laurel because of weather changes, that it was a very big day at Laurel to have three Match Series races on one day. So the suggestion was, why don't we change the format and let each track have a big event day, run a race in each of the divisions, and we'll just move the series from track to track like NASCAR does. And I didn't think it was feasible to pull that off. It would require too many concessions, changes, whatever, amongst the tracks. It would be too difficult to do, but they were amazing. The horsemen and the track management in moving races and protecting big event days at other tracks and races. And so we've come to this big event day format. So I think that's a very significant change, and it's boding well, obviously. Tomorrow we had over 100 nominations for these four races. And, you know, it's just that number two, the horsemen know the series now. It was new to them last year. Many of them weren't around for the series, you know, 20 years ago. They know it now, and they're very excited about it. And we've got some of the horses that contested the series last year coming back in. My only concern is, you know, we fought the weather last year, and we've got a pretty bad forecast in the region today for heavy rain tonight. I'm just praying that it's not going to take these big turf races off the turf. But we're looking for a big day tomorrow and very excited, and there's a lot of buzz about Match.
Well, you know, as we're talking, I just got a beautiful photograph from John Parada showing me his Match Series trophy for Wild Deputy, who won the three and up
God, yes.
Long on the Dirt. And that's a handsome bronze. Boy, and John says, thanks, Alan.
Well, and hi to John, an old friend.
Love it.
And boy, that takes me back, doesn't it? No, we've got, you know, I'm not a marketing guy, Steve, but this to me is marketing. And I took some of the Match memorabilia and some of the stuff we have this year. I spoke to 100 students at the University of Maryland the day before yesterday, and tried to talk to them how we struggle to market in our industry, and here's a way of trying to brand an event. They really liked it. We got some beautiful stuff this year. We've got a Match brand, our website, matchseries.com. If you see our advertising on the industry websites, we're very creative. And we've done a nice job with, I like to say, we're killing an elephant with a pea shooter with the amount of money I have to do this. I think we're hitting it out of the park.
Well, looking forward to tomorrow. Hope the weather does not impact. And we're going to try to get to at least one of the venues this spring, summer, to broadcast leading into one of the days. And the action tomorrow, we'll talk later about the sequence. And, of course, in addition to the Match races, there's also the Tessio and the girls race, too, for the Win and Urines, to go to Black Eyed Susan and Preakness. Speaking of which, let me get that topic in here. The news coming that the Northern Grandstand, the oldest continuously used portion of Pimlico, can't be utilized for public seating. And Alan, was this a politically motivated condemnation? What's your read on what transpired here?
Well, I don't have the inside scoop on why it was announced the day after our legislative session ended. The timing seemed odd, not only to the local politicians, to the Baltimore Sun, but even within the industry. That, and I think the problem for the Strana Group with this announcement is that if they in fact knew that there was a problem with the grandstand and that they would have to close it, why didn't they advise the legislature when it was discussing what to do about Pimlico and whether to move the Preakness? Why didn't they notify the legislative leadership in the General Assembly during the session? So I haven't seen the engineering report. The city's now sending in engineers to do their own independent investigation. If in fact they had information that requires this closing, I would have certainly disclosed it. It would have certainly buttressed their argument. I'm not sure why they waited until after. But at the end of the day, it does point out the fact, and Steve, you've been there, it's an aging facility. It cannot be fixed. And if you, whatever it is you try to fix, if you wanted to rebuild that portion of the grandstand, does it make sense to do so? Why wouldn't you just tear it down now and put temporary seating up, which is what a lot of venues do in sports today?
Sure.
So all this did was, in my opinion, it just complicated the discussion and probably didn't cast the Strana Group's efforts to move the Preakness in a favorable light. And they've got valid arguments. I mean, we're talking about, medication, and we're talking about breakdowns. This whole Pimlico situation is extraordinarily complicated and difficult. I would tell you that I don't see the Preakness moving for at least another 3-4 years at the earliest, if it were to happen. And I think we're all just going to try to feel our way through now and see over the next year how this is going to play out.
Well, again, another watch and wait and see kind of a storyline. I also want to go back to a story we discussed 2 weeks ago. I had Diane Volz join us for our horse health segment this week, Alan, and she continues to deal, and her staff continues to deal with the fallout from this New York State Board of Veterinary Medicine letter that seems to be motivated by one or two individuals that have created a scenario where, you know, her holistic therapy is being denied horses. Is there any more that you can offer in terms of either New York THA or any dealing that can motivate a correct rectification to this situation?
Well, we're still having conversations in hopes that we can resolve this without resort to litigation. At the end of the day, I suspect that what we will have to do is to go into court and seek what we call a declaratory ruling, declaring that the therapy that's being used here and those who are performing the service is not involved in the diagnosis of illness or injury in the horse, that and does not require the services of a veterinarian or a vet tech. I think, as I said a few weeks ago, there's an almost analogous situation from 2009 involving equine dentistry. The Department of Education wrote a similar letter of opposition to anyone performing equine dentistry who was not a veterinarian or a vet tech, and the courts overturned that ruling. So probably the fastest route for us would be to file for a declaratory ruling based on that ruling and other information we have. And I'm actually comfortable that the New York Gaming Commission will agree with our position when we go into court. So I think it will buttress our argument. My disappointment for wonderful people like Diane is that these things take time, and we're not going to get a quick resolution, unfortunately. This is just not the way the system works, unless we can somehow convince the powers that be to allow this short of litigation. But I haven't seen that happen, but I wouldn't rule it out.
All right, I wanted to ask, given she has widespread support from so many top horsemen and owners that, you know, over close to three decades of work, it just and that the fact that it's the only place, among jurisdictions that is, restricting access to the horses is just silly, and especially
we share their frustration. I mean, I'm having a hard time with the logic of this, and it's, when you have to go up against the regulatory community and others and try to get some common sense out of this, it's very difficult when you just can't apply logic and common sense.
Alan Foreman, as always, we can always dot a lot of I's and cross a lot of T's with an Alan Foreman visit, and appreciate it, and give the baby a kiss, and a good Pesach to you and the Foremans.
Thank you, and happy holidays to everybody. Happy Easter, happy Passover, and everybody stay safe and healthy, and let's everybody take a deep breath in this industry, and let's get back together and start having conversations that are going to move us all forward.
Well put. Alan Foreman, everybody. We'll take a timeout right here. We're getting close to the top of the hour, so we'll probably come back and call it hour two. Jay Pribman is going to join us, and Nick Tamaro, Hammer, and Marty McGee, and much, much more. We'll also get a visit in with Marcus Hirsch. We'll talk about that Charlestown Classic. Marcus doing the work there. And Scully and DeRosa. Lots to do. 2 hours to do it at the races. Weekend preview.